This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The new Broadway review, Dream, is a tribute to the lyrics of Johnny Mercer. He wrote an extraordinary number of hits, including One for My Baby, That Old Black Magic, Fools Rush In, Day Out, Moon River, Blues in the Night, Come Rain or Shine, Satin Doll, and Jeepers Creepers. On this archive edition, we have an interview with one of the performers in the new show, Margaret Whiting. Her father, Richard Whiting, was one of Mercer's songwriting partners. Here's Johnny Mercer talking about his career for the Lyrics and Lyricists series at Manhattan's 92nd Street Y in 1971.
Right after that, I did get another job in Hollywood, and I got a job at Warner Brothers writing with one of my favorite composers, fortunately for me, and his name was Richard Whiting. And I now would like to introduce a little girl whom I first heard sing when she was about 12 years old. She sang like an angel then, and she sings like one, Margaret Whiting.
I am not such a clever one about the latest fads. I admit I was never one adored by local lads. Not that I ever try to be a saint. I'm the type that they classify as quaint. I'm old-fashioned. I love the moonlight. I love the old-fashioned things, the sound of rain upon a windowpane, the starry song that April sings. This year's fancies are passing fancies, but sighing sighs, holding hands, these my heart understands. I'm old-fashioned, but I...
Margaret Whiting, singing a lyric by Johnny Mercer, melody by Jerome Kern. Kern was Uncle Jerry to her when she was young. When her father died, Johnny Mercer was like a surrogate father. She made her first records for Mercer's Capitol label when she was a teenager in the 1940s. Throughout her career, she's paid tribute to Mercer songs and to the songs composed by her father, such as My Ideal, Guilty, She's Funny That Way, and The Good Ship Lollipop. When I spoke with Margaret Whiting in 1987, we opened with her recording of a song co-written by her father and Johnny Mercer.
I search for phrases to sing your praises, but there aren't any magic adjectives to tell you all you are. You're just too marvelous for words like glorious, glamorous, that old standby amorous. It's all too wonderful. I'll never find the words that say enough, tell enough. I mean, they're just not swell enough. You're much too much and just too very, very to ever be in Webster's dictionary. And so I'm borrowing a love song from the birds to tell you that you're marvelous, too marvelous for words.
Margaret Whiting, I bet you remember when your father wrote that song.
Well, kind of, because I was quite young when he wrote it. He wrote it with Johnny Mercer, and it was for Ruby Keeler in a picture called Ready, Willing, and Able. It had to be before 1938, and I'm not sure the year, but I was still young, but I remember going into my father's studio every day when I came home from school or when my mother would allow me in, and he would always play what he'd written that day. So I remember hearing it and liking it, and I still do.
Did you assume that all girls had fathers who stayed at the piano most of the day writing songs?
Yes, because my girlfriend was Harry Warren's daughter, and she and I went to school together, and what she had, I had. In other words, one day at my house, I might have Jerome Kern, Uncle Jerry, or I might have Benny Goodman, who my father did a picture for. Or at Harry Warren's, we might have Tommy Dorsey, or we might have Jimmy Dorsey, or we might have Glenn Miller. We might have young Frank Sinatra, Jack Leonard. So I thought everybody, you know, had the same kind of bringing up. I went to school with William Powell's son and Victor McLaughlin's son and all kinds of people like that, Fanny Bryce's daughter and son. So I just thought, well, everybody had a famous parent, and we didn't even think of them as famous. Oh, Daddy did this, and my daddy painted that, and my father directed this, or my mother was in this picture. And we were all very calm and cool about it.
Did you learn all of your father's songs as soon as they were written?
I think I knew a lot of songs when I was 2 and 3 years old. Well, yes, it would be played around the house, and then the records would be played of it, and then people would perform it.
One of your father's better-known songs is On the Good Ship Lollipop, which is, I think, one of his less important songs, but it's a very famous song.
You're right. It is a less important song musically, but it's like it's such a standard because Shirley Temple has lived with so many of us, and that's her biggest song.
Did you have a hard time tolerating Shirley Temple when you were young?
I liked her.
Did you?
I met her, and I went on the set a few times, and she was such a famous person, but such a natural little girl with all those curls, and she had that great sense of humor, and she could tap dance like mad. And my father adored her, but I was responsible for that song. It's strange, but my greatest thrill was to come home and go into the studio and have my father say, well, this is what I've written, and he would play many songs for me, or he would say, I'm working on this song, and I'm having trouble, or he would play Cole Porter's new songs that he had gotten hold of, or Richard Rodgers and Larry Hart. But he was having great trouble writing for Shirley Temple because he had to write a very young kind of a melody, and Sidney Clare, who wrote the lyric, was having trouble writing a lyric. They couldn't come up with an idea, in other words, for this child who was this immense movie star. Had to be innocent, had to be fun, had to be cute. I came in with an all-day, a lollipop, a sucker, but it was a lollipop, and I'd had it all over my mouth. I was sucking it on it all the way home from school. So I gave my father a big kiss, and then I was drooling over the piano, and he said, get away from me. Get away from me. You're so sticky. Get rid of that lollipop. Margaret, that's terrible. You're going to get it all over the piano. That's it. That's it. And I thought he'd gone crazy, and he said, that's it. Thank you. Lollipop, lollipop. And he went to the phone, and he called Sidney Clare. He said, Margaret just came in with a big lollipop and got it all over my face and all over the piano. But what a wonderful idea. She gave me the idea. What about Shirley singing On the Good Ship Lollipop? And he was very good at titles. He wrote a couple of lyrics himself. So Sidney said, that's wonderful. I'll call you back. I'll go to work on that. So he said, thank you. He said, give Margaret a big kiss, whether it's sticky or not, and thank her for it. It's a wonderful idea.
Well, you started recording songs when you were a teenager.
Oh, yes.
And they were songs whose lyrics were pretty sophisticated and lyrics about love, like That Old Black Magic. Were you able to comprehend what it was you were singing about as a teenager?
Not really. But I was lucky enough, to have Harold Arlen and Johnny Mercer, as the composer of that, tell me how to do it. Rhythmically, Harold Arlen wrote such great music. I mean, he was really into blues. He and Gershwin were the two composers that wrote that kind of music. And
so what would he tell you?
Well,
when you were singing
one of his songs? He would tell me to emphasize certain notes and emphasize certain words and emphasize certain beats. Like he said, that old black magic has me in its spell. He said, do it like that. Don't go, that old black magic. Don't make it legato. Phrase it, that old black magic has me in its spell. And Johnny would say, use the word black and emphasize it. That old black magic. So those men just It's like being in a bind or being in a place where the walls closed in and there was nowhere to go but the right way because they were there teaching me.
That must have just been great.
Oh, it was marvelous. And to have all those kind of songwriters around. Johnny and Frank Lesser taught me the importance of reading a lyric. Johnny Mercer often said to me, Margaret, it's like a one-act play, each song. Now, if it's a rhythm song, then you have fun with it. And you find the words to really emphasize, the important words, and you do it rhythmically, and you have fun. But on a ballad, if it's a torch song or if it's a story that you want to tell, then you've got to be very careful, and you've got to find the climax, where it's going, and do it like a play.
We're featuring a 1987 interview with Margaret Whiting. She stars in the new Broadway revue Dream, paying tribute to the lyrics of Johnny Mercer. More after a break. This is Fresh Air.
Singer Margaret Whiting is my guest. I want to play a recent recording of a song that was your first hit, your father's song, My Ideal. You have known the song and have been singing the song for
many years.
What goes through your mind when you sing it now?
To try to make it new and fresh, as if I'm singing it for the first time, because audiences do not know me, some of them. Audiences do not know the song. But more important, really, is that many people do know, and that's one of their memories of me. So I always have to sing it as well, or if not better, than any of the other songs, because that's a memory song to them. And they love the fact my father wrote it and I sang it. So I try to think of... It could be Jack, whom you know that we'll talk about, that I go with now. It could be a love when I was a kid, but it's an image of someone that could be my ideal. And will I recognize him? In other words, again, reading the lyric and getting that innocent, honest, first time I ever sang it feeling.
Let's listen to my guest, Margaret Whiting, singing a song written by her father, Richard Whiting. This is My Ideal.
Long ago, my heart and mind got together and designed a wonderful boy for me. Oh, what a fantasy! Though the idol of my heart can't be ordered a la carte, I wonder if he will be always a fantasy. Will I ever find the boy on my mind? One maybe he's a dream, and yet he may be just around the corner waiting for me. Will I recognize that light in his eyes that no other eyes reveal? Or will I pass him by and never even know that he was my ideal? Will I recognize that light in his eyes that no other eye I'll trust in fate, and so I wait for my ideal, for my ideal.
My Ideal, sung by my guest, Margaret Whiting. It's a really beautiful rendition of it, and I should say that this was just recorded a few years ago.
Well, it's one of my favorite songs, and it was my father's favorite song. He would play this before he'd start to write something else. He adored this song, and he'd always say, oh, God, I hope I can write another one like it. And there's something kind of special about it. It was my beginning, my roots on records, and I used to sing it before even I started on records. I was on NBC for 2 years with Gordon Jenkins and David Rose conducting for me, and I'd always sing this song along the line because it was one of the first songs I knew, and it kind of fit me. So whenever I sing it, it's special.
You came of age professionally during World War II.
Yes, absolutely.
And even, I think, toured a few times with Bob Hope.
Oh, I toured with him. I was with him for 7 years. So I toured a lot of places with Bob Hope.
What did you learn from those tours, both about show business and about things like timing?
Oh, everything. When you work with someone like Eddie Cantor, and I was fortunate enough to work with Eddie and Jack Carson, and then Hope, if you start to move on a line, he grabs you. He says, never move on a line because the audience watches the movement.
You mean like on a punchline?
Yes. Well, or anything. If you're gonna go back and forth. Hey, Bob, I heard you went to Camp Jun today. Did you have a good time? And if I start moving, whatever he's going to say, they're going to pay attention to me. They're not going to hear the punchline. And timing is such an important thing. I learned it from Red Skelton. Learned it from all these marvelous geniuses, Jack Benny, that I worked with.
We only have a couple of minutes left. There's one other thing I wanted to ask you about singing. You grew up the daughter of one of the great American composers, Richard Whiting. Your extended family were some of the greatest composers, Jerome Kern and Johnny Mercer. Did you grow up thinking that to sing a song you really had to stick to the composer's intention, stick to what was on the page, both the lyric and the music? Because a lot of singers will stray from that and will reinterpret a song.
Well, I reinterpret now. But I certainly did stick to what they said because my father said to me, look, sing the songs the way we wrote them. Took us a long time. That's our craft. We're professional. And that stuck with me. And, of course, Johnny and Harold and everybody said, you know, sing them the way we wrote them or the way we sing them as we teach them to you. But recently I've had more of a jazz sound and gone in a little bit different direction, as has Rosemary Clooney. But I think we're still singing them traditionally, but in a different way. I mean, I'm not going to louse up a lyric because I adore those lyrics. And I'm certainly not going to, I may bend a note here and there, but I'm going to give it a different conception, but within the architecture of the song, the foundation of the song, because that's the way I was taught. But stylists are the people that take a song the way I sing it and then do it completely differently, and bravo for them.
Margaret Whiting, recorded in 1987. She's now starring in the Broadway revue Dream, a tribute to the lyrics of Johnny Mercer. Johnny Mercer talked about and performed his songs in 1971 as part of the Lyrics and Lyricists series at Manhattan's 92nd Street Y. That recording has been released on CD by DRG Records. As part of the show, he was interviewed by the series director, Maurice Levine.
That leads to that classic question, which everyone asks, what comes first, the melody or the lyric? And I gather from what you've said that you like to have a good melody before you.
With me, I prefer that.
Right.
I much prefer that.
Your Parbrick said the same thing.
Yeah. Well, you know why? He feels music like a composer, and so do I. So we understand the music. We know where the accents should come. And I don't mean to sound conceited when I say this, but I've often had a lot of good lyrics loused up by writing them first. Because the guy doesn't understand what I'm, the meter that I want. I'd rather try and catch the mood of his tune than have him. Now, there are some exceptions. Mr. Rogers is magnificent, you know, at writing two words. But I think most guys rather do it the other way.
I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Jerry Stahl was a TV writer, husband, father, and junkie. While he was writing Family Fun for ALF, sexual innuendos for Moonlighting, and yuppie predicaments for 30-something, he was spending a lot of time in bathrooms shooting up.
Jerry Stahl had been getting high since high school. He started with pills and marijuana, then moved on to heroin when he was in his early 20s. He says he's been clean since 1992. Now in his 40s, he's the divorced father of an 8-year-old daughter. After he kicked, instead of going back to television, he wrote a memoir called Permanent Midnight, which is both funny and horrifying. The memoir just came out in paperback and is being adapted into a movie starring Ben Stiller, due out next year. I spoke with Jerry Stahl in 1995, and he read from the opening of Permanent Midnight.
The temptation is to be clever, to make it all wildly amusing. I published a story once, at 30 days off the spike, about doing dope in the studio where they shot Alf, banging so much stuff in the soundstage toilet, I heard the furry little puppet hissing my name and scratching at the door. I imagined, in my narco-dementia, that this 3-foot furry TV star, no more than a puppet with attitude, could see right through the bathroom walls. Alf was out there eyeballing all the blood I'd splattered on the mirror, on my fingers, into tiny scarlet puddles at my feet. But it was a family show, and he did not approve. See, it wasn't just the dope. It never is. It was the wrongness of the situation. I wasn't Chet Baker fixing behind the bandstand and blowing his heart out. I wasn't Johnny San Quentin shooting up in his jail tattoos and boosting stereos. I was Jerry Stahl, writing bad TV and hating it, desperately trying to counter his shame at the loathsome squareness of what he did with the secret hipness of what he thought he really was. The thing is, all my heroes were junkies. Lenny Bruce, Keith Richards, William Burroughs, Miles Davis, Hubert Selby Jr. These guys were cool. They were committed. They would not have been caught dead doing an ALF episode.
Jerry Stahl, did it always feel absurd and incongruous to be a junkie writing sitcoms?
That's the best thing it felt, was absurd and incongruous. It was basically mortifying on a 24-hour basis.
What did you feel you should really be doing?
Well, I was a very pretentious young guy, and I kept thinking, you know, would Dostoevsky be cranking out this Moonlighting right now, you know? And the reality is he probably would, because he was a gambler and he needed the dough. But that was the level I was operating on. And you have to understand about TV, when you consider yourself a writer and an artist with a capital A or a little A, you think of yourself as having a voice and being original, but thing about TV, it's not about creativity, it's the opposite. It's about sounding like the guy who wrote the pilot, so that when you write those lovable characters, they sound just like they did last week. So you're basically a high-paid parrot in a very corporate environment, and I was not really a 9-to-5 kind of guy.
You're very funny in the book. You write that perhaps underneath the Bill Burroughs facade was a Dick Van Patten dying to get out. Did you ever think that heroin was going to, like, make you hipper?
Well, the lamer I got, the more desperately I think I clung to that particular illusion, because the really most grotesque revelation and the most hideous admission for me is that I was kind of good at it, you know? It was like I was kind of half William Burroughs, half Maury Amsterdam, you know? kind of a Maury Burroughs thing going on. So that, you know, I was like this sort of borscht belt junkie guy, you know what I mean? Because I could write gags. I still can. And a part of me always loved that stuff. It's just that, you know, Rose Marie wasn't hanging out. You know what I mean? The reality was it was slightly less glamorous and intriguing than working for Aetna Life and Casualty.
Did the people at ALF or Moonlighting or any of the TV shows you worked for realize that you were a junkie?
At the time, I'd like to think they didn't. I certainly know that they probably figured, man, he sweats a lot, sure seems to get the flu and spend an awful lot of those bathroom breaks just not coming back for a really long time. But they probably just thought I had some kind of weird, you know, malarial parasite of some kind. You know, down the road, now I've run into some of these people, they said, no, we didn't think you were a junkie, we just thought you were kind of weird and damp.
Weird and damp?
Well, you know, you always sweat a lot when you run out of stuff.
Oh.
And then when you shoot the stuff, you get a little kind of moist. And, of course, I always had to wear long sleeves, even on scorching, you know, 190-degree L.A. days, which is kind of a dead giveaway. But as I said before, it is such a square environment that I don't think it occurred to them that while they were bringing in their cappuccino and croissant, I was bringing in my Riggs and Dilaudids.
Was it easier for you to write for programs that you had contempt for than it would have been to write something that you took really seriously?
Absolutely true. That is the story of my life. If I didn't care about it and thought it was dreck, I was really great at it, which is probably why I drifted more and more towards these kind of jobs for which I had contempt, which, if we can get real kind of dime store Freudian, was probably just because I had a lot of contempt for myself, you know, which is why I was doing those jobs. But you can sort of allay that self-loathing with the fact that they're just throwing money at you by the fistful. I mean, I had hundreds just spilling out of my pockets when I was in television.
Did you have to fake it a lot while you were working for television and getting high all the time?
Well, the beautiful thing about heroin is, you know, beautiful thing, listen to me. The thing that made it work and was actually most hideous about it is it induced a kind of faux conviviality. So that the only way I could muster the enthusiasm while taking the meetings to seem like, yeah, that's a great idea, Alf goes to a psychiatrist, was to get high and just find the right chemical balance so that I went in and these guys were just, God, he's just such a warm, understanding fellow, you know? And I would take these great meetings so that when I was face to face, I gave the appearance for 15 minutes of sort of being on the beam and concentrated and sharing their enthusiasm until, of course, I was back in my hovel, you know, staring at this electric, wondering what the hell I had gotten myself into and where were the drugs.
So you were pretty good at faking things.
I was terribly good. At one time, I had lined up a pilot, a movie deal, a memoir for somebody else, I think Frank Zappa's memoir of all things, to be ghostwritten, and I was still on Moonlighting. And subsequently, these people would call and say, where is the script? And I would be, well, what script? And then my agent would just have another minor aneurysm and get me out of it.
Jerry Stahl is my guest, and he's written a memoir about his years as a junkie. Several of those years, he was also writing for TV shows. His memoir is called Permanent Midnight. There was a period when you were making about $5,000 a week, but you say you were shooting about six. How much do you shoot a day for $6,000 worth of heroin?
Well, by that time, it wasn't just heroin. I was shooting coke as well. So I was shooting a few grams of heroin, which is about 100 a pop.
How many syringes worth is that?
I was just kind of around the clock, maybe a couple times an hour, especially when you start shooting speedballs, the late John Belushi's favorite drug.
That's cocaine and heroin.
That's cocaine and heroin. When you start shooting coke, it's not like heroin where you can only shoot it and then do it a couple hours later. You just become a human pincushion. You literally cannot stop fixing. So at that point, I was just a complete drug glutton.
How did you get out of television completely?
I fell out. You have to understand, it is very hard to fail in Hollywood at that level because the only reason people are giving you money is because the last people gave you money. It has nothing to do with talent. So I just blew gig after gig and basically disappeared off the map.
My guest is Jerry Stahl, author of the memoir Permanent Midnight. More after a break. This is Fresh Air.